This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After Republicans lost control of both houses of Congress last month, President Bush made it clear that policy on Iraq will change. The next day, he accepted the resignation of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Then, after the release of the Iraq Study Group's report, he promised to redefine a new course in Iraq, first before the end of the year, and then early next year. But as that postponement suggests, changing course in core policies does not happen easily or overnight, and dramatic shifts in rhetoric can be awkward for any administration, particularly one as steadfast as the current White House. This was evident at yesterday's news conference when a reporter asked the president why he'd changed his assessment of the war from definitely winning to neither winning nor losing in the space of just 2 months.
The first comment was done in this spirit. I believe that we're going to win. I believe that, by the way, if I didn't think that, I wouldn't have our troops there. That's what you got to know. We're going to succeed.
To some, that sounded more like the now abandoned stay the course than a prescription for change. Later on in this program, C-SPAN CEO Brian Lamb wants control over the cameras in Congress. But first, fixing a failed policy in Iraq. Why is it so hard? Why does it take so long? And amid all the pressure from public opinion, from the new Congress, from the Iraq Study Group, Iraqi politicians, the military, and various political constituencies, who should the president be listening to? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. And joining us now is David Gergen, director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard University, who worked for several presidents of both political parties. And he joins us from a studio at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And David, nice to talk to you.
Good to talk to you again, Neil.
And listening to the president yesterday, you could hear just how awkward it is to get caught in the switches.
Oh, it really is. This process of making decisions about a new course, the most fateful decisions that the president will make about Iraq since the decisions to invade back in 2002, 2003. And clearly it's become a messy and chaotic and wounding process for the president. You know, we thought we had a mess on our hands on Iraq. Increasingly, the president has a mess on his hands just trying to make a decision about where to go next.
Mm-hmm. What you've been in the White House, I'm not saying under this conditions of this kind of crisis, but nevertheless, there's a tremendous inertia for a policy that's been developed over a course of years.
Oh, there sure is. And it I think, reflects the underlying reality, and that is we have a president whose great strength is his resolution. But as with so many leaders, your strength can become your weakness, and that is resolution can become stubbornness and an unwillingness to recognize or accept new realities as the realities change around you. We've seen this before, by the way, Neil, in wartime.
Mm-hmm.
President Harry Truman had a very hard time coming to grips with the realities of Korea, and it took a new President Dwight Eisenhower to bring that to final settlement. When Eisenhower famously promised, "I will go to Korea," mm-hmm. when he was a candidate, and then did just that and settled it. And again, in Vietnam, when Lyndon Johnson, got caught in the switches, as you put it, and fired his defense secretary, but still couldn't come up with a coherent policy for victory. It took a new president. And by the way, an agonizingly long time of 5 years to end that one. But increasingly, it looks like it's going to be a take a new president before we really do find our way out of Iraq.
A new president, so another 2 years, you figure?
I see very little evidence that this president is willing to do anything other than to hang in there and seek this very elusive victory. I mean, it would be clearly the mood of the country is swiftly fallen on the other side and said more 70% said in a poll with the Wall Street Journal, NBC, that they would like to see us begin reducing the number of troops within 6 months. They don't want an immediate pullout, but they want to see some form of disengagement. And clearly the president, instead of choosing that option of disengagement, the one represented by the Baker-Hamilton Commission. Clearly, the president does not want to do that, and he's still clinging to the notion that he can escalate and achieve victory. The two basic choices are, do we escalate or do we begin disengagement? Baker-Hamilton concluded we ought to begin disengagement and do the best we can to patch up Iraq, but especially try to keep stability in the region, making sure it didn't go up in flames. The president still is clinging to the notion that victory is possible in Iraq. Many, many, many people don't agree with that anymore. And the only way you get there is through escalation, which is the other big option.
To be fair, the Iraq Study Group did mention the surge idea as at least one option.
It did, but it didn't. It was a very temporary sort of thing. And what the military is telling the president is, if Mr. President, if you want to put more troops in there, we've got to have a mission. We don't want to go in there for just 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, and it's clear also that dissension within the military is becoming an issue here too.
Isn't it fascinating? It's part of the box the president has now built for himself, in which he now finds the top coming down on top of him. In effect, the president has said all along, go back to your original question, to whom should the president listen as he makes his decisions? Throughout this war, he has told the public continually, I will listen to the commanders on the ground to make my decisions. These decisions will not be driven by polls back in the United States or by politicians back in the United States. So here his commanders are now telling him not to do what he really wants to do, which is to put more troops in. And, General Abizaid, who's now going to retire, interestingly enough, very quickly, more quickly than some of us thought, his joint chiefs and others are saying, Mr. President, we disagree with you about this notion of putting 20,000 more troops in there. So the president is facing this dilemma now of whether, in fact, after telling us for months and months that he would listen to his commanders, whether he's going to override it because he finds advice inconvenient and inconsistent with what he personally wants to do. If he were to do that, and it looks like as if he might in January, if he were to do that, of course, that's going to give enormous ammunition to his critics to say even your joint chiefs don't want to do this. And it's also going to erode public confidence in the wisdom of what he is doing. The president needs to come before the country when he does in January with something which represents more than his own personal predilection or notion. It has to represent some kind of coalition consensus certainly within his own government, but hopefully with Democrats as well. But the notion that he can do this all by himself or be out there on the lonely point with a couple of advisors that he's rounded up, I think is just not tenable.
Let's get callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guest, of course, David Gergen. And let's begin with Adam. Adam's calling us from Salt Lake City.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I had to make this comment. I'm a Marine, active duty, and of course my opinions represent my own, not that of the Marine Corps. But I personally don't want my fate to be decided by public opinion or, for that matter, congressmen and senators that don't really have the war experience or the necessary training to make these kind of decisions. And the decisions that the president does make, I think, should be based not just on the commanders on the ground, but also those, his advisors and the Joint Chiefs. And anything beyond that turns into, political struggle and who's trying to make a name for themselves. And that's not what I want to be my guiding directive when I'm there on the ground getting shot at.
That's very helpful. Now let's ask you this question. The president and some of his advisors believe the only way to win is to apparently they believe this is to have a significant increase in the number of troops on the ground. That would include Marines as well as Army. And yet the Joint Chiefs are disagreeing with that. Should the president therefore listen to the Joint Chiefs?
Honestly, I think that if the president has a clear goal in mind, and that's what the Joint Chiefs are advising him on, that's one thing. I don't think that that's happening. If there was a clear goal, say our goal was to stand up the Iraqi army and by doing so be able to pull out soon, then troops wouldn't be helpful. But if the goal is to secure the population and set up a democratic society, then more troops may be necessary. So I think the goal isn't clear enough defined for the advisors to really be listened to in one way or another. But I don't know that the Joint Chiefs are telling them that completely, because that's not what I hear from my chain of command. So I don't know. I haven't been there to see that.
Adam, thanks very much for the call, and we wish you good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Clear goals, David Gergen. The president's, because he scaled back his rhetoric, Iraq no longer seeks a free and democratic Iraq that would be a beacon and an engine for change in the Middle East, but an Iraq that could govern itself, sustain itself, defend itself, and be an ally in the war on terrorism, considerably scaled down ambitions. And the goals don't seem to be clear right now.
Well, I think the goal of a stable, self-sustaining Iraq that is not a troublemaker in the region is pretty clear. What's not clear to me is the strategy of how you get there. One strategy which General Abizaid seemed to represent and seemed to be reflected in the Iraq study group was that we increasingly embed U.S. advisors among the Iraqi troops and let them do and within the coming months, let them do more and more of the securing of these various cities and putting down of sectarian violence and the insurgency. Another strategy, an alternative strategy, is go in with a lot more American troops and let the American troops secure the places, and over time, behind that, come in with some sort of more effective Iraqi army. That's a fairly basic decision, Neil, which way you go on that. It's also been true that the strategy up until now is that let's get the politics and the economics done as we try to get the security done. And as the New York Times observed yesterday in its analysis, there are some in the administration saying, no, let's flip that on its head. Let's get the military security done first, and then after that's done, after we secure these cities, there's less violence, then we can work on the politics and economics. That General Abizaid, for example, is a proponent of you got to get the politics and economics done. We can't, even as we're doing the military, you can't wait on that. You can't leave us hanging out there as a military. But there are people now, and the president may be among them, who say, no. The first objective, the strategy is to flood the zone with U.S. troops, put Americans on street corners, quell the violence as best we can in Baghdad, and then work on the politics and economics. So there are some pretty basic strategic decisions to be made here, and I think that's what the everybody can sort of verbally agree, let's have a stable Iraq. I mean, that's our goal. Let's have a stable Iraq and a stable region. But there's deep disagreement on how you get there. And a lot of people believe that putting a lot more troops in there is too late anyway.
David Gergen, thanks very much for your time, as always.
Thank you, Neil.
David Gergen, director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and a former White House communications director. He joined us today from a studio at Harvard. When we come back from a break, David Sanger of the New York Times and Peter Spiegel of the Los Angeles Times join us to talk about this administration's particular difficulties in trying to change course. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing why it is so hard for presidents to change policy in times of crisis. The White House has tentatively admitted to an Iraq policy that, while they don't call it a failure, is certainly no longer referred to as a success. Joining us now are two men who've covered this administration for years, David Sanger, the New York Times White House correspondent, and Peter Spiegel, Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. They've been both kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. And here's another clip from President Bush's news conference yesterday, responding to a reporter's question about whether the president would override the advice of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and order a surge, even if they opposed it.
If you conclude that a surge in troop levels in Iraq is needed, would you overrule your military commanders if they felt it was not a good idea?
That's a dangerous hypothetical question. I'm not condemning you. You're allowed to ask anything you want. Let me wait and gather all the recommendations from Bob Gates, from our military, from diplomats on the ground. It's interesting, the Iraqis' point of view. And then I'll report back to you as to whether or not I support a surge or not. Nice try.
David Sanger, as the president is responding to that dangerous hypothetical, of course, Robert Gates is his new Secretary of Defense, who's in Iraq at the moment, talking with the commanders on the ground. And the president has already been forced to postpone this speech in which he's going to redefine Iraqi policy once, and he's still gathering new information?
Well, he is still gathering new information, and Secretary Gates's trip is, I think, part of that. But The question was a really interesting one. It was only dangerous for the president, and it was dangerous for the president because this is a president who has said many, many times that he will take his advice from the generals about how many troops are needed on the ground. I remember being at a press conference he gave in Chicago back in the summer, I think it was in July, where he was very explicit on this point. And yet what's happened in the past few months is clearly a rethinking of that policy. You did not hear the president go back to what was the bromide of the first half of the year, which is it's the generals who ask for more troops, and if they ask for more, I'll give it to them.
And let me ask Peter Spiegel, we did not hear generals talking off the record and telling reporters, we're not so happy with this president's policy.
Yes, until, oddly, Donald Rumsfeld left the scene. It's interesting how that has changed of late. I would argue there is a bit, the analysis of the Bush versus the generals misses a bit of a point, and that is the generals are not monolithic. The Pentagon, within the Pentagon, there has been just as vigorous a debate on troop levels as there has been in the administration. The fact of the matter is, this Joint Chiefs of Staff and this general, General Abizade, who's the Central Command, this is their plan. This is their plan. They're not about to back off of this. There are other generals who have begun talking to a lot of reporters who have said all along, we've never had enough troops. If we really want to fight a proper counterinsurgency, we're going to have troop levels in Baghdad where we can do that. And you're starting to hear those voices bubble up. So I think this sort of dialectic that we're seeing is in the analysis, that it's the White House versus the generals, I think is misplaced a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think the generals currently in place have been wedded to this plan for some time and don't want to be proven wrong. But there are other quite intelligent and quite bright generals out there who have been arguing for another plan for some time, and they're beginning to get their voices heard in this mm-hmm. debate.
And David Sanger, obviously the Secretary of Defense is not the only senior official to have been changed in the past few months. There's a new White House Chief of Staff. There's a new White House Press Secretary. There's who is the President listening to, and who should he be listening to, getting back to our original question in this program, as he deliberates this change in policy?
Well, one would expect, and I think it's the case, that he's listening to more than just the generals. And he should be, because the surge, while an interesting question, is, at least to my mind, hardly the only question, and maybe not even the first question. You could argue that a surge is needed to create the political space to be able to do what has not happened over the past 3.5 or 4 years.
A little security so that we could begin to get some economic things done, begin to restore electricity, all these sorts of things.
That's right. But the failure over the past 3.5 years has been to get those other things done. And so the surge is only useful if you can make a persuasive case that all those other things are going to be done in the time frame of that surge. A time frame may not be announced. If they aren't done, then the question is, what happens the day after the surge is over? Are we back to where we are today? And in that case, is it worth the additional cost in lives? Hmm.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. And this is Jim. Jim's calling us from Spencer, Iowa.
Yes. I'd like to make the comment that I think the president should be listening to the taxpayers that are having to foot the bill for this war. I believe $30 billion was the original estimate. Now we need another $100 billion. I don't think that we can afford this kind of freedom. We could probably pay the insurgents to leave us alone, and it would be cheaper.
That seems to be certainly the cost of the war, and nobody's even quite sure what those costs are, David Sanger. But nevertheless, there are other constituencies out there besides the military, the new Congress, and various political groups, including the base of the president's own party.
That's right. And actually, the cost here is a very difficult thing to assess. I mean, there's a guess that right now this has been between $300 and $400 billion, and the clock is ticking at about $8 billion a month. But if you go into the Iraq Study Group's report from a few weeks ago, they guess they say that the ultimate cost, when you're done paying for the benefits, the health issues, and all that, could be upwards of $2 trillion over a number of decades. Mm-hmm. Unclear to me quite how they've gotten to that number, but that's quite an astounding number.
Jim, thanks very much for the call. And Peter Spiegel, the other initiative that does seem to have gone through, I don't think the orders have been signed as yet by Secretary Gates, but that is this idea of a permanent increase in the size of the Army and the Marine Corps, something which, again, just a couple of months ago, would have been vociferously opposed by the Secretary of Defense.
Yeah, and that's not going to be cheap either. I mean, the amazing thing that's going on when you look at the defense budget is we are fighting a war that is somewhere near $500 billion right now. At the same time, we have killed absolutely no weapon systems. We are every single service has a multi-billion-dollar defense program. All the Air Force is still getting all their fighter planes. The Navy's all getting all their new destroyers. The Army's getting all their new future combat system. There has not been a hard look at the defense budget and saying, look, we cannot afford to fight a war and buy all this new great equipment at the same time.
And replace all the Humvees and tanks and armored personnel carriers that are being worn out in Iraq.
Many of which are sitting at Army depots because there's not enough supplemental funding to rebuild them.
All right, let's get another caller on the line. Now, this is Matt. Matt calling us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hey, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
In the speech that you, that President Bush is to give in January, I think what's probably needed is sort of a moonshot, honestly, like what President Kennedy sort of rallied the country around, you know, putting a man on the moon. I think this whole concept of a surge is a good idea, but I think probably what's needed is a tsunami. I think, you know, men are what hold the land, or soldiers hold land. You need bodies, not and. I think the military has spent a lot of effort on technology, and I think you just alluded to this earlier, that we're spending a lot of money on fighter planes and boats, and this is a land war. I think massive increase in number of troop levels will eventually get that society back on track, or at least have a hope of getting to the point where they can get to a democracy.
Mm-hmm. Yet, the moonshot analogy is probably a good one, but the president has tried the moonshot approach before, David Sanger.
He has, and while your caller has a very interesting point, I think the question that raises is how many troops, if it's a very large number, if we're talking 100,000 or 200,000, where would they come from? Because everybody in the military will tell you, and Peter can speak on this much better than I can, we don't have the bodies, you know, in place and ready to go. And then the third and the really critical political question is, for how long? Because the polls all indicate that the political sustainability of this war is diminishing fast. And the president's own party has made it, and the leaders of that party have made it pretty clear that they don't want to go into the 2008 election, which is not all that far along, with Iraq still as a major issue, because they just went through one of those and they didn't really like how it turned out.
Mm-hmm. And Peter Spiegel, let me ask you again. The Pentagon looks at those polls too. They remember the experience of Vietnam, where they were fighting an unpopular war. They remember the difference between that and Gulf War I.
I mean, the parallels are a little scary. I mean, if you look at what happened in 1968, where Johnson finally decided he was going to fire McNamara, he brought in a new defense secretary. The new defense secretary came in and said, we are not going to increase the troops. William Westmoreland requested another, I think, 250,000 troops. He turned them down. They brought in a new general to run the war, Creighton Abrams. What did he advise? New military advisors, you know, flood the zone, counterinsurgency. A lot of the things we're talking about now, the problem is it was too late. The American public had turned against the war by 1968, and from 68 to 73, we saw combat troops withdrawn and the whole thing collapsed. So even if they get the strategy right now, even if they get that right, the risk is the American public fails to support this plan, mm-hmm. and the whole thing collapses just like Vietnam. And that is, we have been told on the record, frankly, by commanders who are currently in the Pentagon saying they are very nervous about that, that whatever plan they come up with may be undermined by lack of American support.
It may be too late for, as the Iraq Study Group was worried about, too, that by the time they proposed a plan, it would be overtaken by events. Let me also ask you, and Matt, by the way, thanks very much for the call. Let me also ask you if, at the same time this policy is being openly debated in Washington, and there is the one thing that everybody seems to agree on, proposed by the Iraq Study Group, is its fundamental description of the situation as a grave and deteriorating situation, as opposed to the rather sunnier assessments the administration was putting out, that seems to be righter rather than wrong. Nevertheless, does it make the generals at the Pentagon nervous when there is open indecision in the White House?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, much like the stock market, generals don't like uncertainty. And particularly, I think one of the interesting things we haven't talked about yet is the fact that General Abizaid is retiring. He has been, he's, you know, right or wrong, the war has not gone well. He's been the commander, but he's generally viewed as a very bright guy.
He was always viewed as the right man in the right job, spoke Arabic, familiar with the cultural situation.
I mean, the question is, you know, even smart men make mistakes. The question is, who replaces him. And this idea of a moonshot, it would be interesting to see from a public relations standpoint to get the Americans on their side again. Does he pick a general who has been advocating this counterinsurgency strategy, this surge, for a lot of times? There are a lot of guys who are seen as in that camp. This guy who's mentioned quite a bit and has been on the cover of Time magazine, Lieutenant General David Petraeus, is the one who's mentioned most often. He headed the 101st Airborne during the invasion, went to northern Iraq, and actually practiced this. And actually, northern Iraq was quiet. He's been advocating this at Fort Leavenworth, leading military think tanks right now, new counterinsurgency strategy. Again, Abizay has put guys in bases, in big bases. Occasionally, they go off into neighborhoods and clear them out. They're never good enough guys to sort of hold the neighborhood. Petraeus has really advocated, get those guys out of those big bases. Put them in platoons on street corners. Get to know the population. Protect that population. And once you win them over, that's how you generate the goodwill. That's how you create the space for the politics and the economic stuff to happen.
And a critic would say you're creating targets.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt. That's another problem. There's no doubt casualties would go up. I mean, Peter Corelli, who's the commander of the day-to-day until about last week in Iraq, tried some of the stuff in Baghdad over the last few months. Give a guy a shovel, you know, let's get those guys out there. And what happened? We saw a surge in American deaths. So if you have this moonshot press conference where you introduce your new general and you exercise your new strategy, what you're going to have to see is we may see American deaths go up quite substantially in the short run. But in the long run, this is going to be for the good because it's going to stop the violence from spreading.
Yes, but in the short and medium run, unless it begins working immediately, your political window is rapidly closing.
Well, this is David's point. I mean, this is David's point. For how long can we do it? I mean, if you again, you talk to the smart guys who've been talking about this. You know, we have won counterinsurgencies in the past. Malaya in the 1950s where the Brits did it. That took 12 years. Mm. It took 12 years.
We're talking about the difficulties of fixing a failed policy under fire. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get John on the line. John calling us from Miami.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just would like to ask a question. If, given what we know about his past attitudes and actions, is this president capable of changing his mind and adopting a different policy? Is he capable of admitting a mistake?
David Sanger?
You know, the strength that President Bush has that his political advocates have always commended him for is his steadfastness. To his critics, that's an incredible stubbornness, and it's the flip side of the same set of characteristics. We have seen, however, though, that when his back is up against the wall because his own party has said to him that something is not politically tenable and he's got opposition out in the country, he has given in. He gave in on the creation of the 9/11 Commission and an intelligence commission. He's given in on a number of domestic issues, but only after Department of Homeland Security is a great example. It was initially Joe Lieberman's legislation. It became the White House legislation. But this is different, because his whole presidential legacy sits on this. This is so much of a bigger decision than any that he has reversed before. And so what we think we know about him may or may not apply.
John, thanks very much for the call. As we look ahead on this, and David Sanger, I know you have to leave us shortly, but I wonder, as you look ahead to the timing of this speech, postponed once, were we locked into the first week in January? Are we locked in at this point? Do we know when this is going to happen? Or could this drag out for some time?
It could drag out for a while, but I think it would be unlikely to drag out beyond the State of the Union address, which is the third week of January. The State of the Union traditionally is the explanation of the administration's broad goals. And so I think that he would want to give a specific speech on Iraq and then resonate some of those themes again in the State of the Union as he went on to other things. But the other question gets to what Peter has mentioned, which is the degree of uncertainty right now is itself harmful to morale, to the generals, to the overall perception of our allies about the decisiveness of this administration. So I don't think he can sit on this for that long.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned politics. This is a man who is never going to run for office again. Sure, he has to listen to his political party, but he does not have to listen as much as he did 2 years ago.
Or even 2 months ago. I think that's absolutely right. And one should always be careful about that, because presidents in their last 2 years consider the fact that they're not running again quite liberating. And in this case, he has a vice president who's also said he's not running. So it's a rather unusual situation in that regard. But he is also very attuned to his legacy, I think. And that raises, again, the question of the civilian side of this, which it's dangerous to lose track of. He needs to come up with a set of incentives that will get the Iraqis to do what he thinks they need to do, because, as the old saying goes, we can't want it more than they do.
David Sanger, thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times. When we continue after a short break, we'll have more questions and continue with Peter Spiegel, the Pentagon correspondent for The Los Angeles Times. Again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Plus, the struggle over control of the cameras in the House of Representatives. Brian Lamb will join us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's continue discussing the struggle on defining a new policy in the war in Iraq. Still with us is Peter Spiegel, who's the Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Bear. Bear calling us from Panama City Beach in Florida.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I find it very curious, this word, this buzzword, surge. It's a clever word. It's a typical Bush word, Bush administration word. What they should really be using here in place of surge is what the new plan will be from this president, and that word is escalation.
Mm-hmm. I guess the difference, Peter, technically would be a surge is very temporary. Escalation has a more permanent sound to it.
Yeah, I mean, this is...
I was asking Peter.
Yeah, I mean, that is the issue. The problem that David raised before is that if we were to look at the structure of the Army and the Marine Corps right now, there is not enough manpower to do anything beyond a surge. Unless you want to extend tours permanently to something like 15, 16 months, the only way you can actually put more troops on the ground is to temporarily extend one group that's going out and rush in another group that's coming in. Mm. And that's going to give us maybe 6 to 8 months. And that's why they're calling it a surge, because it'll be a temporary increase. And again, that goes against a lot of what these smart guys are saying in terms of how to fight a counterinsurgency war. You can't just do it temporarily. This has to be a long-term thing.
If they're going to do it. But, Bear, escalation, of course, is a word also politically loaded. It's highly reminiscent of Vietnam.
And that's why they don't want to use it.
Thanks very much for the call.
You got it.
Bye-bye. And finally, Peter, let me ask you, you were mentioning the decision of General John Abizaid to leave. Was he pushed? Did he jump? Is he clearing the way for a new policy for the new defense chief to appoint his own commander-in-chief?
I think it's more of the clearing of the way. I mean, frankly, people I talk to who are friends of his and have worked with his says he's actually been wanting to leave for some time. And it was Rumsfeld actually blocked him from leaving and said, look, you are my commander. You are not leaving until I let you go. You know, he said yesterday that, you know, that the Abizaid family hasn't thought this has been too long. You know, it's a tough job. He's been running a war for 3.5 years. Before that, he was a deputy commander. He's been traveling a lot to the region. I think what happened was he submitted his papers to retire around early November. It was at that time clear that the president was rethinking his strategy. And he said, look, you know, if the president wants a new strategy, he needs a new commander because this is my plan. And that's, I think, the reason he decided that was the time.
Peter Spiegel, thanks very much for being with us today. Peter Spiegel is the Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and he joined us here in Studio 3A. And when we come back, the secret FBI files of John Lennon.